Yeah, so we started looking at finitely presented groups, and what I did last time is basically show that free groups exist. A free group is a group that on a certain generating set, such that every other group which can be generated by a generating set of the same cardinality is a homomorphic image. And what you actually have is the property you know from vector spaces, that you can map the generators of a free group arbitrarily to another group, and it will always extend to homomorphism. In vector spaces, you can do that always.
If they're with a basis, because
of linear independent. So in some way, in a free group, generators also are in a certain way independent. So every, if we have a free group of rank n, and rank is the number of generators, every group that can be generated by n generators will be a quotient. We can use this to describe groups. And the mechanism we have seen for this, and that's what we finished with on Tuesday, is that of a presentation. So this was parallel to the presentations. And that was already there. So we basically had there just the definition, what is a presentation or what is a finitely presented group. If we have a free group, free group on generators. Of course, with a free group, we also always have particular generators on which it is free. There could be other generators on which it is free, but it's basically like a vector space at a basis. Free group on generators, let's say A1 up to AK, then what we write as A1 up to AK, vertical line, and now we write words W1 in the AI, and I will use this underline for the set of letters. So this is a word. By this I mean a word, or I don't even need the I there, I don't want a particular one, I just want underscore. So a word in A1 up to AK. The word in letters is simply, I write the letters one after the other, and since I have groups, I also allow to invert the letters. Okay, so, and I can pick another one, W2 in the letters and so forth up to WL in these letters. So the important thing is I want finitely many generators, I want finitely many such words, and what is such a word? Such a word is just an element in F. Well, what is this? By this, we denote the group F modulo N, where N is the smallest normal subgroup of F, such that all the words are, all these elements are contained in them. So I'm just describing a quotient of a free group, and I'm describing the quotient by describing the normal subgroup, and I'm describing the normal subgroup by giving a normal subgroup generating set. So this normal subgroups doesn't just consist of products in these elements, but of product also products involving conjugates of these elements.
Right. So that is a presentation. And I mentioned we call these things relators, and it is often convenient to allow not just to write words, but to write instead a relation, left is equal to right, which you could interpret as left inverse times right being in the normal subgroup. Okay. Right. Yeah, so this is a finite presentation. And F modulo N is a finitely presented group. Okay. People often make a formal distinction between these two things. Essentially, that they say, here I have a group and here I have an object which is some strings. And that depends on if you want to do something with this. You need to allow yourself operations which are changing things there. And you can't do this necessarily with a group, because your group could temporarily, while you change your relators, your group could change. So when people talk about a presentation, that often is actually formally some kind of string object, and that to write a proper definition of this, you actually then need to introduce more stuff about formal languages. Okay. So for example, I could take a group generated by an element S, by an element R, and I want that S square is equal to 1, R to the 4 is equal to 1, and there I'm already using, so this equal to 1 I wouldn't really need to write, but people often find it convenient to write equalities, and I want that RS is equal to SR inverse, or if I wanted to write this as a relator, then I could take a quotient, divide one side off, so I could, for example, have RS inverse as a relator. And the reason why one often writes it in terms of equalities is that this makes it easier to manipulate words and see that certain words are the same. So the best of all worlds is if we actually can, and we can do this in this situation, that we can manipulate this relation, that we can manipulate every word to some kind of normal form. We can do this here. We know with this relation that if we have the exponents of R and S, we can always make non-negative between here 0 and 1, and here between 0 and 3, right? Because we know we can take the exponents modulo 2 or modulo 4. And then if we have an S after an R, we can move instead the S in front of the R, and therefore bring everything in the form some power of S side times some power of R. And we see that way that this group has 8 elements. That's the dihedral group of order A. S is a reflection, and R is the rotation. Okay. In general, such things are much harder. And in general, that is... Let me talk about that. Okay. Yeah, that is a presentation for this group. In general, a group has many different presentations. in the same way as a group has many different generating sets, and even for a particular generating set, the group could have different presentations. I mean, the most pathetic way how I could make it different is that I add a relator which doesn't really do anything new, something which just describes what the group does. Okay, but anyhow holds in the group. So I could, for example, if S has order 2, then S conjugated by R also has order 2. I could add this. It would be formally a different presentation, but of course it doesn't change something there. So you might wonder whether one can somehow try to simplify presentations or so. There is a process, this is called Tietze transformations, which can try to do this. Basically, these are obvious things you can do with a presentation. So for example, I could add another generator. I could add a generator T and a relation T is, say, S times R. That's not changing anything in the group. So that's trying to emulates a little bit what stuff like base change does, or even base change with dependencies. Or if I would have a relation here, if I had a generator T here, and I had a relation which I could interpret as expressing T in terms of S and R, I could have thrown T out and that relation out, and all other occurrences of T replace them by S times R. And there are some similarly things that if I can write one relator as a product of several of the other relators, if I had the relator S squared times R4, I could throw it out, or I can introduce such relators. Or I can conjugate relators because it's a normal subgroup generating set, and so on. So the process of these operations, these are called Tietze transformations, and there is a theorem which says that if you have two presentations for the same group, you can find a sequence of such transformations which will manipulate one presentation into the other one. Okay. To state this formally, you need to have a way to formally talk about presentations as strings. That's why I didn't write it down. That looks initially great. The problem is just this is purely an existence state. And the proof isn't really very hard. What you basically do is something like the proof of Steinitz's theorem that you can exchange a vector that if you have a basis and you have a new vector, you can put that vector in and throw another vector out. And you do something like this. You first take your new generators, you add the new generators, write them as words, then the old generators, and add the new relation and throw others then out. And it is just, it just says such a process exists, but you have no way of doing this systematically or finding out how to do it. It is potentially would need to build up intermediately a very long presentation. And so this is not something which you can have the only algorithm which would potentially find it would basically do all possible things and try out and hope at some point I arrive there, and that is just not feasible. And you never know, have I not reached it because it's not possible, or have I not reached it because I just haven't searched long enough? Right.
So is this formally then an NP-hard problem to decide whether or not two presentations?
It is hard. It is a problem which cannot be solved. It is a problem which cannot be solved on a Turing machine. Let me do a bit more, and then I'll state this later. Right. So let me do a few more examples. So this would be D8. I probably should have started with a cyclic group of order N that can be generated by an element A, where I have the relator A to the N. Okay, that all looks hunky-dory. But the next one is a little bit more surprising. I could take for A5 two generators A and B, where A square is the identity, B cubed is the identity, and A times B is order 5. Okay. And that you can find such elements in A5, that's not that very hard. You pick an element of order 2, you pick an element of order 3. Oh, element of order 2. Let's say I pick 1, 2, 3, 4. You pick an element of order 3 and you want that they generate the group, so this element of order 3 should better move the point 5. So let's say I pick 1, 2, 5. And if I now form the product of these two, I have 1 goes to 2 goes to 5. 5 stays... No, that doesn't. 1, 2, 5 doesn't work. Let's try 1, 3, 5. Oh, yes, I need to. Of course, I need to also move these two. If I have 1, 2, 5, 3, 4 never gets touched. Yeah. So 1 would go to 2, stays fixed. 2 would go to 1, would go to 3. 3 would go to 4, stays fixed. 4 would go to 3, would go to 5. Oh, this comes out so nicely. right. So these elements would fulfill these relations. But why couldn't that group be larger? That is not obvious. So in some way, yes, it's plausible that this has something, that A5 has something to do with it. These are relations which hold for A5. But that this group is really A5 requires more work. And if you look at this, you really can't get as nicely a normal form as here. You don't have a relation, you can't interpret this relation in an obvious way to move always A in front of B. And you can't all expect that this has happened, because then you just would have 6 elements, but you have 60. So actually, you need to, if you want to do this, you need to argue with product that you can't have a product AB, AB, AB with more than 4 repetitions. But what do you do with something like AB square, AB square, AB square, and so on? Okay. So this group has order 60. If I replace the 5 by 7, it's next prime, suddenly this becomes infinite. This becomes very much infinite. And any group which is a quotient of this, where I have a 7, is called a Hurwitz group. And there is a large number of groups, and the question is which ones are, and they have certain nice properties. So, AB, A squared, B cubed, AB to the 7 is infinite. Quotients are called Hurwitz groups, and that name might already tell you that this has suddenly goes very much into geometry territory. Right, so it is the presentations are a very convenient way of describing a group in a short form. And we'll have a few more examples in a moment. But I mean, even if you just count the number of symbols you write, if you wrote compared with writing down generators for A5, this is not bad. And there will be other cases which I'll show you in a moment. Where this goes much better. So it's a very convenient way to write down groups. It's also, to some extent, a very natural way, because, for example, fundamental groups of topological spaces arise naturally. They're the natural description you get by essentially seeing how the triangles for in the triangulation of this space are put together, give you a presentation. But they behave in some way rather unstable. There, you do small changes, and suddenly the behavior changes completely. And you don't have an easy way. I mean, if I would have asked you what happens in these cases, you probably wouldn't have been able to guess easily that they are so different. Okay. There is one way for describing presentations which is often used, and I think it is worth to describe what it does. So these are Coxeter presentations. And they are related to something which are called Dynkin diagrams. So what is a Dynkin diagram? A Dynkin diagram is simply a finite graph where the edges are labeled with integers from with positive integers. So the Dynkin diagram. Oh, sorry, I should once at least write this name properly so you can see how it is spelled. Is a finite graph whose edges are labeled with positive integers, and actually I want integers which go from 3 upwards. And the convention is often that people do not write the 3. That is just because that is the generic case. And sometimes people define it that they just say is are labeled with positive integers and then they add plus 2 or something like that. But, okay. Yeah, so that is a Dynkin diagram. The interesting thing is that there is a class of these diagrams which are associated, which actually are as graphs not very interesting. For example, they typically don't have loops. And these graphs are associated to a wide class of interesting mathematical objects. And one way how they are related is that from such a graph we can write down a presentation. Okay, the mechanism for writing down the presentation is nothing magical. The interesting thing is that these presentations often give us something useful. So we associated presentation well, the associated presentation is that the vertices correspond to the generators and I add relations, namely, I have relations that every generator has order 2. Okay, so this doesn't go for arbitrary groups, but it works for a large class of interesting groups. Every generator has order 2. And I want to have relations that if A and B are generators, then AB to the 2k is the identity. If the edge AB has label K. And we generalize that if we have no edge, we want to have label 2. AB to the K. Sorry. AB to the K is the identity. And we have K equals 2 if no edge. And okay, this case of no edge, what does this actually mean? Then we would have AB, AB is 1. AB, AB is 1. And because A and B both have order 2, that is equivalent, well, to AB is equal to B inverse A inverse, but this, since they have order 2, they are their own inverse, so this is equivalent to AB is equal to BA. So no edge means the generator is commutative. Okay, and indeed I can do this more generally. This is written in the form, you can write this instead, that AB, AB, and so forth, that I have K letters is equal to BA, BA, and I also have K letters here. Okay. And these relations are called Braid relations. Oh, I should have brought my... Let me just pick up my... Do I know where they are? I'll be back in a moment because I'll just want to... I forgot to bring three strings to explain why this is why they are. Since it's before Easter, some kind of challah type bread. if you search for challah bread and braid relations or so, you find articles which describe mathematically how you can make it look particularly nice. My wife has asked me, "Oh, how should I do it?" And I said, "Oh, here is this article. This is really nice. It gives you exactly the relations." He said, "Oh, no, that's not." Anyhow, a braid is simply that you have some strings and you twist them in some way. Okay. So if you actually look at the process of twisting, you can reduce it to taking one string and moving it in front of the other string, or moving it in the back of the other string. So, strings, and we can of course have more. I mean, if we have only two, there isn't really that much what we can do. We can twist it around and untwist it and do so. So, three is the smallest example where something not completely boring is happening.
Let's take three strings, and for the moment I forget about these square relations. I have generator A is move string 1 over string 2. One right over string 2. And I mean by string 1, 2, and so forth, the string which currently is the one in position 1. I'm not meaning the black string. The green string could be string 1, for example, in this situation. Right? And A inverse would be under. Right? Because if I take string 1 right over string 2 to undo it, I would need to move string 1 right under string 2. And B is move string 2 right over string 3. And B inverse correspondingly. Okay, so if I do this for 3, so here I claim that A, B, A is equal to B, A, B. Okay, let's prove this. What is A, B, A? A moves this string here. B moves this string here. A moves this string here. So I move this here. And basically the assumption when looking at these braids is that things are sitting nice on top, that stuff doesn't move back up. So B moves here. And now I do another A that moves this here. Right? So what I have... Yeah, and I don't know whether you want to sketch this in your notes, how it looks, or shall I... I can try to draw this. So... we have ABA corresponds to this. The first string goes to the very right. Then the second string goes under the first one and then goes here. And finally the third string goes first under the first one and then under the second one. Right? So what is BAB? BAB says move this string in front of the first one. Then move this string over this one here. And now move this over this one here. Okay. And now if I actually allow to move things over, the question is just this, I can move this crossing down here. And it will be topologically the same thing. Okay? So that's why this thing is called a braid relation. If you don't have 3, if you have 4, it doesn't work with strings anymore. But you can still look at it and you can see what you can look at it as a mathematical object. Right. That's the reason why these things are called braid relations. But what I wanted to do is really to give you some examples of presentations. So. For example,
if I take a graph, okay, and now there are finitely many letters, and at some point if people assign letters to things and other people assign letters to things, there is a clash. So the Dynkin diagrams were labeled, A, B, C of certain types were labeled, A, B, C, and so forth. Okay, because that seemed to be convenient. So the Dynkin diagram of type A would be the diagram AN, which has n vertices, well, I take n vertices and I connect them by lines. Okay. So, what would be the corresponding presentation? Corresponding presentation is that I have n generators, A1 up to AN, right? And what relations do I have? I get, when they are connected, I get these great relations, and no label written means 3, right? So I have AI, AI plus 1, AI is equal to AI plus 1, AI, AI plus 1, for all I. And I have, if it's not I and I plus 1, but if I and J are two indices which differ by more than 1, well, then I don't have an edge, then the generators commute. So I have that AI, AJ is equal to AJ, AI, if the difference of I and J is greater or equal than 2. That's the corresponding presentation. Okay. Right. What group is this? I claim this is the group Sn plus 1. Okay, and that's why I'm saying this is really the notation. At some point you tie your own feet. So it's the group, the symmetric group Sn plus 1. Why? Because I choose for Ai the permutation which swaps I and I plus 1. Okay. These are permutations which have order 2. So, I forgot to write that. Ai square is fine. Okay. They have order 2. And now let's just look at what happens if I take, I could write this instead as Ai times Ai plus 1 cubed is 1. And I should also say, this does not say the thing has order 3. It just says it has order dividing 3. I mean, it turns out in this example it has order 3, but one of the things which is awkward with presentations is it could be the trivial. If you write down an arbitrary presentation, it could be the trivial group. That the trivial group fulfills any presentation. The question is, do you have more? So let's just look at what happens if I take the permutation II plus 1 and I multiply with the permutation I plus 1, I plus 2. What do I get? Well, I goes to I plus 1 goes to I plus 2. I plus 2 goes to I plus 1. I plus 1 goes to I stays fixed, has order 3. Okay. So that certainly, that means Sn plus 1 is a quotient of this group. That this group is not larger, again, one needs to do a little bit. One needs to do some work and show that it can't be larger. So this group, so if I do this Dynkin diagram, I get the group
is n plus 1. Okay.
This is perhaps a stupid question since we just erased it, but when you gave the definition, you told us what a Dynkin diagram was. The Coxeter presentation is just a presentation coming from a Dynkin diagram?
Yes, yes, great. Which is in this form, and or which you could have come from a diagram. Sometimes people don't initially write down the presentations and then say, and I can describe them by these diagrams. Okay. So it's a presentation of the form, all the generators have order 2, and all the other relations are of the form AB to some power is the entity. And essentially where this comes from is that initially Coxeter, I mean, this is basically anything of Coxeter is the same person. He looked at easy presentations you can write down easily. And you can say, okay, well, I have generators order 2, and the only relations involve pairs of generators. They don't involve more than 2 generators. And they have this form. Yeah. And Dynkin then, I think actually coming from somewhere else, defined these graphs. And at some point, people realized there's a lot of things which are connected with it. By the way, that in some way I found surprising, with over time, you will see these, if you're going anywhere into algebra combinatorics, you will see these diagrams popping up again. And it will look like something, okay, this must have been known for eternity. Dynkin lived till last year. I think he died in November or December. Yeah. And basically, he did this very early. He did this in his early 20s. And he was very bright, but he was probably also in some way. With this, you have to be lucky to pick the right thing at the right time. But this is really, these kinds of diagrams are one of the strange things which pop up in many different parts of mathematics. And it is not always, often not immediately, but later, not at all clear why they are related. Okay, let's do one other diagram, the diagram of type BN. And that diagram has also n vertices. And I'm just changing this, and I put not a 3 here, but I put a 4 here. Okay, so basically, what is happening, the presentation. My generators have order 2, and it's just this relation changes for the pair 1, 2. Okay? So what can I tell about this? And I won't write down the whole presentation. The whole reason of these diagrams is that this is even shorter than writing down the presentation. Right? So what group do I get here? Well, if I only take these generators here, I get a diagram of type AN. So I would expect that this would, well, it's one vertex less, so this would be an SN, right? Because on N minus 1 vertices, N minus 1 plus 1 is SN. And here I have an element of order 2. Okay, and now that there are some steps which I've hidden to actually prove that it happens, the group which I'm getting is C2 wreath SN. This gives me a generator for one of the C2s, and that SN is these N generators. Okay. And basically, yeah, I mean, some way, because this has a different label, somehow this must play a different role. Yeah, and then that the diagram of type CN is the same diagram, just reverted, so the group is the same. But there are other situations where actually the ordering of the diagram is important. The diagram of type DN has one fork there.
and it turns out, and then there are diagrams of type E, and it turns out there are just very few diagrams for which, if you just take these diagrams alone where the groups are finite and fulfill some other conditions. And therefore you can do with it with a normal alphabet.
So, like, I know Lie groups or whatever, you have, like, you talk about the exceptional ones, like E8 and
yes.
E7. Those all are from the
Dynkin These diagrams. Are from the Dynkin diagrams. Yes, okay. The Dynkin diagram E6 is, I think, this one.
One has it offset to the...
And then there is E7 and E8. So you basically start with something like E and you make it a little bit more complicated. Yes, but that's exactly the thing. And they're just, these groups basically, they're called the Coxeter groups or Weyl groups of type E6, E7, E8, because they don't have otherwise obvious isomorphisms. And they get quite large. Yes, but that's for example, that's one thing where these come up. Exactly. It turns out that the simple groups, you have the sporadic ones, you have the alternating ones, and all the other ones, one can show, they are called Chevalier groups, that in these groups, you have find a certain subgroup which has quotient, has a group which is generated by elements of order 2, and such relations, and you can describe them by this diagram, and that's exactly this kind of group, that's the associated Weyl group. Called Weyl because at the same time, but coming from a different context, Hermann Weyl looked at these, and yeah, there are tons of connections. This is, I mean, apart from prime numbers, so this is probably one of the things which have most influence coming over mathematics. Okay. The one thing I want to mention, just also to have defined the term, if we leave out these square relations, we still have a presentation, we have a group, and this such a group is called a Braid group. And again, these Braid groups, yeah, for just this diagram of type A, the Braid group of type A really describes just the twisting of strings. But you can do braid groups of other types, and again, they occur in various places, and people are interested. So let me braid group only the braid relations, no relations, no AI to the E. Is one relations. So if you have the braid group of type A, for example, then you just leave out these relations. You know, of course, that if you add these relations, if you have a presentation and you add relations, you go get to a factor group, right? You have originally a quotient of a free group with some normal subgroup. If you add relations, you make this normal subgroup larger, so you get potentially a quotient of your group. So the braid group of type A has the symmetric group Sn as n plus 1 as a quotient. Okay. Right. Yeah. So these are some examples of presentations. Basically, just to try to talk you into believing that these are useful things to work with. Okay. Right, we have presentations. Oh yes, and I should just state for completeness, following lemma, if I have a finite group, it has a finite presentation. Has a finite presentation. Why is this the case?
basically, I just need to look at what is called the Cayley graph of that group. So, I need to choose a generating set for the group. If it is finite, I can always find a generating set. In the worst case, I pick every element of the group. Well, I can always leave out the identity. So, consider what is called the Cayley graph. What is the Cayley graph? The vertices are the group elements, and the edges are labeled with generators. So X, I have an edge to Y labeled by G if XG is equal to Y, and G is one of the generators. So it's basically the multiplication table for the group. Right? And I wouldn't even have needed the Cayley graph. I could have just worked with a multiplication table. And now I...
And that's given a choice of your generator.
Yeah, there is some choice of generating set. And I mean, I will not have from every group element X to every group element Y, I will have an edge, only if there is a generator. Okay. And now I can basically encode that Cayley graph in a presentation. Namely, I write every element as a word in generators. I can do this, and I encode every edge as a relation. Okay, so my vertices are certain words in the generators, and if I have some element, let's say I have a vertex which is labeled by the element AB A squared, and I want to know what happens with this if I multiply with a generator B. Well, there will be an edge from every vertex. There is an outgoing edge for every generator, and possibly even generator inverses. Yeah, so I should generator or inverse. Well, with the inverse, you could basically just follow the arrows the other way around. You could look at the incoming arrows. So I have ABA square. If I more want to multiply with B, I just need to follow the edge labeled by B and see where do I end up with. And I will end up with some element which is written in the generators. And if I encode the edges as relations, I can read this off from the relations. Right? So it's probably easiest seen in an example. Let's take S3 generated by two elements A and B, where I have A squared. A is the, yeah, by two elements A, B, and I have A shall be the permutation swapping 1, 2, B shall be the permutation swapping 2, 3. Okay, then what is the Cayley graph? What are my elements? I have the identity. This goes with A to 1, 2, and with A back there. And this element actually is the element A. With B, I'm getting to 2, 3, and again with B, I'm going back. So, next, if I multiply 1, 2 with B, what is happening there? So I need to calculate 1, 2 times 2, 3. That will be 1, 3, 2.
And that would be the element AB. What happens if I multiply B with A, 2, 3 times 1, 2? Then I have get 2 goes to 3, stays fixed. 3 goes to 2, goes to 1. Right? So that's BA. So this is A. This is A. Okay. Then I have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So I need one more element. Okay. And basically, yeah, I mean, this, since these are generators where the Coxeter presentation would hold, I could take ABA or I could take BAB. And ABA is the same as BAB because I have an edge with no number meaning 3. Okay? So my element would be ABA, so let's multiply 1, 3, 2 with 1, 2. That would be 1 goes to 3 under 1, 2, 3 stays fixed. 3 goes to 3 goes to 2 under 1, 2 goes to 1, and 2 stays fixed. And that would happen if I multiply this with A. And so this is ABA, and that is also the same as BAB. So I have here also arrows for B. Okay, so that's the associated Cayley graph. And you can check that from every vertex I have an outgoing A edge and I have an outgoing B edge, and also an incoming A edge and an incoming B edge. So that graph describes completely the multiplication in this group. Right? If I have the vertices are the elements, and if I want to know what happens with an element under a generator, well, I can read this off. So now, how would I write down the presentation? Of course, now I don't get the nice Coxeter type presentation. I get a rather ugly presentation, and the only virtue of it is, it is still finite, because if I take a finite set and I look at all combinations of finite with finite with finite, it's still finite. So what presentation would I get? So I have two generators, A and B. Okay, and now I'm encoding, so this would be here the empty word. So empty word times A, or I don't even write the empty word. A is A. Okay. There are some which I can immediately throw out. A times A is the empty word, right? If I take the vertex A times A is the identity. That's telling me that this arrow goes back here. A times B is the element which I'm labeling AB. And again, this is not very exciting. This is something which I can throw out. AB times B is A. So now I've dealt with... okay, and AB times A is what I label ABA. Okay, that's again not very interesting. If I look at the identity times B, it's B. Yeah, sorry, I should have written this is the element which I will label with B. And B times A is BA. B times B is the identity. So if I have this, I can throw that out, right? Because that is dependent on this one here. If I know that B square is 1, I can use this to reduce this to A is equal to A, and that's not interesting. So I could throw that out as a consequence of this. I have B times A is BA. So all of these relations in some way, the last letter is special. The last letter is the generator, and the rest of it is some vertex. And again, that is not very exciting. BA times A BA times A is B. Again, that would follow from this one, so there is a redundancy. And BA times B is the element which I had labeled ABA. Okay, so that would be... I also need to say what happens with ABA if I multiply, right? ABA times A is AB, which again becomes trivial as a consequence of this, and ABA times B is BA, which using this identity one could also be true. Okay, so that's the associated presentation I would get from this Cayley graph. Okay? And if I write this all down, I can reconstruct the Cayley graph from this presentation. Because the relators all have a particular form. Chop off the last letter of the left-hand side. This is take that generator, and that tells me what edge goes, and the rest is the label of a vertex. So from this presentation, I can reconstruct the Cayley graph, and the Cayley graph is just another way to describe the multiplication table. So these relations all hold in the group, and that group cannot be larger, because from this specific presentation, I can deduce the multiplication table. So that is a presentation for the group I started with. Hooray. Yeah.
The formula that we do is we just give, for each of these vertices, we give them one name.
So we give them one name, and the name as a name as a word in the generator is how I can get it.
And that's why we only wrote it as this bottom one as ABA. So
yes.
When you're acting on each element, you said
yes.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. Great.
Yeah. And if I start with a finite group, I have finitely many vertices, finitely many edges. This gives me finitely much. I get a finite presentation. So every finite group has a finite presentation. It's easy to write down finite presentations, which are infinite groups. For example, if I take the group generated by one element and I don't write down any relation, that's the infinite cyclic group, or the integers under addition. Okay. So we have we define finitely presented groups and presentations. We looked at some examples of presentations, and we've seen indeed every finite group can be described nicely by a presentation. And it turns out that it's probably not worth to write it down just, but you can, for a lot of these sporadic simple groups, you can write down in the end rather short presentations. I mean, they might still fill the whole board. If you want to do this for the monster, you fill the whole board. But that group has order 10 to the 55. And then the whole board actually is a rather small part. So they are a very compact form, but they are unfortunately a form which is looks rather complicated. Okay, so so these presentations came up originally in topology.
because people looked at topological spaces and looked at their fundamental groups, and these were actually one of the early cases of groups, and they wanted to know what is the fundamental group of some space. Can we describe this? And it seemed to be, yes, clearly these are certain identities, can one do this? And famously in 1911, Max Dehn phrased what are called the Dehn problems. And these are actually one of the earliest algorithmically phrased questions. So there is the word problem. And this says, he phrased it slightly differently because at that point they didn't have computers and they didn't have the language of algorithms. So given a finitely presented group, G, is there an algorithm is there an algorithm that decides whether a given word represents the identity? Okay. So one has to be quite careful with the language here and how it's in some way like how you put quantifiers. He allows, I think, if you have different groups there, he allows the algorithm to be there for the group. He doesn't demand that the algorithm is universal. Right, and what does algorithm mean? That's basically would mean you can, using the Turing machine model, you could encode the presentation in some horrible way on a Turing machine. There would be a Turing machine which would hold in a state which has two halting states, and one says the word, and you encode the word. The one state says the word is the identity, the other state says the word is not the identity. And of course, no one would want to do this in practice. Essentially any digital computer, you could reduce by an enormous amount of work to a Turing machine. So algorithm really means also what you would mean now by algorithm on a digital computer. Okay. And the two other problems are the conjugacy problem test whether A test for whether A to the G is equal to B for some element G in G, can I conjugate one element to the other one? And there is the isomorphism problem, which does exactly what it says on the box. Given two groups given by finite presentations, are they isomorphic? And in some way, these are obvious things. Okay, the conjugacy, you might argue, is it or not, but these are obvious things to ask. What can one do with a presentation? Okay. And Dehn looked at certain cases, and in some class of groups, actually, one can solve things nicely. And essentially what he ended up with is a certain geometric algorithm. If you're looking at the Cayley graph, you can try to introduce some kind of metric, basically distance in the graph. And in many toy examples, when you're playing with them, you can say, oh, in some way, I can get to a normal form because I'm somehow seeing that words get shorter. I can apply relations. A relation in the Cayley graph basically will correspond to a loop in the Cayley graph. I allow myself to apply loops to make the word shorter. And in many cases that works okay. In particular, if you start looking at examples you can write down. But it doesn't, and that eventually leads to an area which is called geometric group theory, and nowadays the most prominent thing, so this goes to geometric group theory, and there is a class of groups which are called hyperbolic groups. Hyperbolic groups because basically the metric on the Cayley graph has certain properties which are like hyperbolic geometry. And for these, such things work. But in general, it does not work. Okay, that's why he phrased this as a problem, why he didn't just say why this wasn't a solution. Okay. And now, if you want, fortunately or unfortunately, depending how you look at it, it turns out none of these problems has a solution. So, this is a theorem which is due to a Russian, Novikov, and an American, Boone. And this was both roughly around 1955. I don't remember exactly the year. They proved the word problem in general is not solvable. I mean, if the word problem is not solvable, the other ones are harder. If you can't solve this, you can't expect to solve the other ones. Cannot be. And basically, what this proof does, I mean, the proof is, okay, I mean, first, how on earth do you prove that something cannot be done? There is basically one thing where it has been proven it cannot be done, and that's the stopping problem for Turing machines. So, I said Turing, do you know what a Turing machine is? You don't need the, but very, very roughly, it's a toy model for a computer. It is basically, it's a computer whose storage is a band, and you describe a program, basically, your programming operations are simply you can read off what is currently on the tape. I mean, the tape, this is was based on what computers physically could do initially. You can read off what is on the tape, you can make a decision based on what is there, whether you move right or left, and you write something back on the tape. And it is in some way simple enough that you can actually start making formal statements about this, and it is powerful enough that one can show that at least any programming language which has been defined, you can reduce, if you wanted, you could reduce to a Turing machine. And so if you look at possibility or cost of computing something, typically in the end, this reduces to certain, or you could reduce it to certain notions of Turing machines. And you can make it more complicated, you can add multiple tapes, or you can add more operations, but in the end, it doesn't change things fundamentally in what you can do. Okay. And indeed, that's what they did. Basically, they reduced the problem to a stopping problem of Turing machines by encoding, describing how one can encode a Turing machine in a presentation. And the stopping problem is the problem. Given a Turing machine, you could encode it on a tape. Can you have a Turing machine which would read encode a tape which encodes another Turing machine and decide whether that Turing machine stops? Right? You could have a Turing machine which does not stop. Read something, don't do anything with it, just write a one and move the tape one further, and so on. This will run eternally. And you assume your tape is infinitely long. Can you decide whether it stops? And Turing's idea, which in the end is it's genially easy, is just to say, well, let's assume we would have a universal Turing machine which could decide whether something stops. Let's modify its program slightly. Namely, that if it would decide the machine stops, it will run infinitely, it will run into an infinite loop, which does not stop. And let's feed that machine to itself. And then you have the usual contradiction, all person X saying all people like me are liars or something like that. And that doesn't work. So they reduce this to this stopping problem for Turing machines. So this word problem cannot be solved. I mean, not just we are too stupid to solve it, but in a model which is reducible to Turing machines, it cannot be solved in general. And there aren't that many problems in mathematics where this is doable. For example, this gets even into areas like cryptography. Practical cryptography often uses things like trying to reduce to problems like factorization into primes. It seems to be hard, but there no one has proven a lower bound that it really is a hard problem. What has been proven is that primality test can be done in polynomial time, and it seems that factorization cannot be done in polynomial time, but no one has a proof or even an idea how one would prove it, or even whether it's true. It might be wrong. And here actually is a problem which cannot be solved. The one issue, if you want to look at this for cryptography, is just it. In general, it cannot be solved, but it can be solved in a large number of cases. So it is actually, unless in their proof they construct one example, but also you can't decide if someone comes with a presentation, it's not obviously to say the word problem is hard for this. So, that can be difficult, but basically what this means is that one cannot hope to have an algorithm or generically algorithms which would do things for finitely presented groups and would say, here, I calculate certain results. I calculate, is this group finite? You can't even test, does a given presentation describe a trivial group or a non-trivial group? So the only thing, and that to some extent limits what one can do with finitely presented groups. Basically, what you can do is two classes of things. There are some methods which can be lucky, where you can be lucky, and which will terminate and tell you something about the group. And tell you, for example, the index of a subgroup, and if you do this for the trivial subgroup, you get the order of the group. And from that, you can get a faithful permutation representation, and so on. So that is one class of methods. This is called coset enumeration, and I'll tell you probably next time what this does. And there is one other thing what can be done easily, namely to test whether a map on generators is a homomorphism. So the only thing easily tested is
is a map given on generators of homomorphism, why can this be tested easily? Because I just need to test whether the images fulfill the relators. Right? On the free group, it certainly, if I would go back to the free group and map the generators of the free group, it is an homomorphism. So the only thing I need to see is this homomorphism compatible with the quotient I have? Is the kernel of this homomorphism, does it contain the normal subgroup which I quotient out to describe the finitely presented group, namely what I just test the relators on the generator images. So, for example, if I take my symmetric group S3 with a presentation A squared, B squared, and AB cubed, so if I want to have a homomorphism, then the map A goes to 1, 2, B goes to 2, 3. This gives me a homomorphism. And that's basically what I did before. I just verify that these two permutations fulfill these relations. On the other hand, if I would map A to 1, 2, and B to 3, 4, that's not the case, because A times B has order 2, and so AB cubed would not be the identity. So, if I have presentation, or if I have a finitely presented group, the one thing I can do moderately or comparatively easily is to check whether the map on generators is a homomorphism. And therefore, a large number of methods to work with such groups and find out information about these groups is to look at certain homomorphisms. They are to find homomorphisms with particular, where the image lies in a particular class. Okay. I don't want to go into details of what these algorithms do internally, but I think it's useful to at least mention what exists there and what these things do, or some of these do. So, what I could do is, I have finitely many generators, I could say, take the symmetric group of a particular degree, let's say I have two generators, let's say I want degree 7, I run through all pairs of elements of S7 and check whether this pair of elements fulfills my relation, all the relations. If it does, I have such a homomorphism. Right? So what I would find is all subgroups of S7 which are isomorphic to a quotient of my group. Well, but if I have a subgroup of index up to 7, I get a homomorphism into S7, namely the action of the cosets. So what I get there is algorithms which are called low index subgroups. So what they do is, well, they find up to conjugacy all subgroups
of index up to n, and how do they do this? By testing all k tuples of elements of Sn for being possible images. So this is a very much an exponential algorithm. This doesn't go very far. If you write down the presentation, you probably typically can get to somewhere n equals 10 to 20 or so. If you're lucky, you can get to somewhere 40, 50, but this doesn't really go that far. But it finds certain subgroups. Okay. And that does not contradict this impossibility result. Because what this just tells me, potentially, is my group has no subgroups of index up to 20, apart from the group itself. But you don't know it could have a subgroup of index 21, or it could be trivial. You don't know where you are. So that's why this method works, but others do not. Okay. Or what you can do is you can look at the largest abelian quotient. How do I get the largest abelian quotient? By adding relations of the form AB is equal to BA for any pair of generators. Right? That will be the largest. Or if you want, if you write this as a relator, you get exactly the commutator, and you're factoring out the commutators, and you are in the situation that you factor out the commutators generate the derived subgroup. So you would factor out the derived subgroup, and therefore get the largest abelian quotient. Okay. So, you could just take your relators as relators for an abelian group. And those of you who had already 567 have seen that if we have the presentation of an abelian group, there we can find out what the structure is. Namely, we can interpret it as a Z module, as a module over a principal ideal domain. You basically write the relations as rows in a matrix. Because it's abelian, every relation will have the form A to some power times B to some power times C to some power, and so forth. You will never have ABA, but ABA would become A squared B. So you just write these exponents as rows in a matrix, and you calculate the elementary divisors of this matrix. Okay. If you haven't seen that, ignore it. We don't need to do this here. You'll see that method at some point in an algebra class. And we get the structure. We get the structure even nicely in the normal form for an abelian group, for a finally generated abelian group. So we can find out what is the structure of the commutator factor group. Again, doesn't get us around the problem, because if the group is actually trivial, it will tell us there is no abelian quotient. Mm-hmm. But you don't know, is it because it is trivial, or is it the group could be the alternating group on 100,000 points? Then it only has a subgroup, the smallest index subgroup has index 100,000. There is no abelian quotient. But you can't... This method doesn't allow you to go that deep into the group, because it's exponential time. And if you say, oh, but I allow myself time up to 100,000, it could be 200,000, it could be 900,000 or whatever. So that's why you can't solve these things. Okay. We are basically out of time for today. So what I'm going to do next time is to show you some examples of what one can do in these cases here. And then we will look at a method which is called coset enumeration, which can actually prove certain results. That's essentially the one method which can really prove things about the order of the group, but it is not guaranteed to, you can't predict that it terminates after some time. So it's not really an algorithm. It's a method that is of potentially unbounded runtime. Anyhow, that's more about that next time. Thank you very much.